24 ноября пройдет русский марш.
Наш опыт проведения русского марша показал,
что проведение 21 октября подали в мэрию Москвы
заявку. После многолетнего перерыва русский марш возвращается в центр Москвы.
Очередной русский марш столкнулся с проблемой раскола среди
национал-демократы, национал-социалисты, фанаты, скинхеды.
Русский марш — это в поддержку чего?
Вот его величество русский народ.
Русские вперед!
Putin and the nationalists and Putin. It's always been a strained and troubled bond, marked alternatively by love, hate, fear, and loathing. It's always been more of an alliance of convenience than one of conviction. Putin's Kremlin and Russia's nationalists have long used each other, and have long eyed each other with suspicion and apprehension. And while the Ukraine crisis appear to unite Putin and Russia's nationalists as never before, the old cracks in this dysfunctional partnership are again becoming manifest, with unpredictable consequences. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there.
And also joining us via Skype from Washington, D.C. is Kevin Rothrock, editor of Runet Echo at Global Voices and an indispensable observer of the Russian blogosphere. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us from Bern, Switzerland, making her first but hopefully not last appearance in the podcast, is Alina Polyakova, a senior research fellow at the University of Bern and an expert on the far right in Europe. Welcome, Alina.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. We're glad to have you. Now, next week's Russian March has long been the seminal event of the nationalist calendar, and it will merit watching for a number of different reasons this year. It'll be the first march since the annexation of Crimea and all the patriotic and xenophobic and nationalist fervor that unleashed. It'll be held in Crimea, actually, for the first time. It'll take place with Alexei Navalny, who still has a following among nationalists, languishing under house arrest. And it will come amid a creeping Kremlin crackdown of some nationalist groups, including the flagship nationalist website with the charming name Sputnik in Pogrom. I say charming ironically. Kevin, you recently wrote an interesting piece titled Vladimir Putin and the Russian Nationalists Don't Get Along. Here's Why. What do you expect to see at the march next week? And more importantly, how do you see the Kremlin's relations with nationalist groups evolving? Because this has been a bit of a roller coaster ride.
So I would agree that the Ruski March or the Russian March is worth watching this year, just as it is every year. I mean, one, it's just a really interesting spectacle, as you said. It's charming, you know, in scare quotes is how I would describe
right.
it. For that reason alone, I think it's something worth watching. And I know that, you know, Russian news outlets are going to be, you know, present there taking lots of photos because there are always lots of, you know, weirdos and scary people there. I don't think it's going to be as big as it has been in the past. In fact, I was mentioning this earlier too before we started recording. There's a new Levada poll out today, in fact, and it shows that support nationwide for the Russian march across all of Russia is down 9%. It was recorded at 40% last year, which is one of the higher scores it's ever had, and or it is the highest scores, I guess, since they've been measuring this since 2006, and now it's back down to 31%. I think that the Crimea patriotism has really put a damper on this kind of Russian nationalism. And so even Sputniki Pogrom, the website run by Yegor Prasvirnin, the one who's also supposedly getting pressured by the FSB and so on, he's actually come out with an op-ed in his website saying, you know, and he's done this in the past too, this is not new. He says that, you know, the people that go to the Russian march are racists and marginals, and they work in league with the liberals who are opposed to true Russian nationalism, because they're basically this scary boogeyman that goes out, and then the liberals can beat them up. And, you know, it's this unholy union of liberals and racists. And he has this very elaborate argument. But I do think that it's not going to be as big as it has been in the past. I think that conditions are such that it's not good for those kinds of Russian nationalists. Now, people like Sputnik Pogrom, or the people that write for them, people that read them, I think it's boom times for them. It's just that their breed of nationalism isn't suited to marching in the street with, you know, scary banners and so on. Prosperin himself has said that his kind of nationalism is you either meet as an intellectual in a coffee house or a tea house in Moscow and discuss things civilly, or you pick up a gun and you go to the Donbass and you fight for ethnic Russians and so on. But I do think that the divides within Russian nationalists – now, of course, the people that go to the Russian March say they are Russian nationalists. Prosperin and his breed of nationalists say that, no, you're not a nationalist. I'm a nationalist. You're a racist. There is no divide among nationalists. I mean, there is a divide because you're calling the other nationalists you don't like racist and anyway.
Right, right.
Yeah, but those sorts of divisions I think are stronger now than they have been in the past, and it's going to weaken the turnout anyway at the rally.
You raise a real interesting point here about these, like, who is a nationalist and who is not. And Mark, you've long pointed out, correctly I would add, that we need to distinguish between so-called state nationalists who are more concerned with issues of empire and, on the other hand, ethnic nationalists who are concerned with things like, in quotes, Russia for Russians. Putin presumably has the former with him right now. The latter are perhaps under question, wouldn't you say?
Yes, and they've always been under question. I mean, I think the key thing is obviously it's worth noting that when we talk about these different types of nationalists, we're talking about strands of opinion rather than sort of coherent movements. So that it's possible there's going to be, you know, some of the quote-unquote racists who will support Putin for all kinds of reasons and state nationalists who may well disagree because they don't think he's doing enough for the Russian state or whatever. But yeah, broadly speaking, because the key thing is that Putin clearly is a nationalist, but nonetheless he is a nationalist who also wants to control the movement. I mean, I think that's the key thing. From his point of view, these are all very handy instruments of rule. I mean, even more than nationalist, Putin is a Putinist. You know, he wants to maintain his authority. He wants to maintain the authority of his system. And so although his natural bias is clearly towards extending Russian control over areas which he thinks ought to be within Russia's sphere of influence and strengthening Russia's place in the world and all those kinds of things, he's not yet at the point where he's going to sort of put his own authority on the line for that. So from his point of view, he's happy to see all kinds of patriotic, loyal movements, so long as they are useful to the state, so long as they accept their subordination to the state, and so long as they realize that their role is to be, in the good classic Soviet terms, transmission belts.
Now, the Russian March historically has been associated with the ethnic nationalists, the Russia for Russia people, less than the state nationalists who are concerned with issues of empire and imperialism and so on and serving the state. Do we expect Tuesday's march to be an anti-Kremlin affair? It has kind of like veered that way in the past.
I would have thought that there's going to be an element of that. But I mean, the very fact that once again it's going through Lubyana, a Moscow district with lots of Central Asian and other sort of non-Russians, is on the one hand characteristically sort of provocative. But on the other hand, in some ways it actually works to the advantage of the Kremlin because it will keep people's eyes on basically the racist angle. Rather than anything else. Now, obviously, that can have blowback impacts for the Kremlin, because part of the question is, well, why are they here? I think the obvious answer is they're doing all the work that Russians aren't able to or wanting to do. But I think that we're still some way away from actually seeing more than just grumblings and mutterings. Even if you look at sort of my other sort of current fascination, Strelkov, and his sort of current machinations. And it's interesting because on the one hand, he clearly is a figure on the nationalist wing who can, around whom a lot of anti-Kremlin feelings can cohere. But nonetheless, in terms of his rhetoric, he's still being very, very careful to sort of every opportunity express his loyalty to the Kremlin and to the current government. I don't think people yet in the sort of the heart of these nationalist movements, even on the sort of the Russian march, thuggish, racist end of it, are yet willing to really start cohering around a notion of saying that we are opposed to the Kremlin, if nothing else, because they realize that's pretty dangerous.
Right. And Strelkov, it's interesting you should bring up Strelkov, because one thing I've noticed, and actually I read a piece on this the other day, about how his media appearances have dwindled down almost to nothing. And you could plot it on a graph, and it's basically linear. It's been going down every month. It's going down farther and farther to the point where now it's almost down to zero. Alina, you follow nationalists for a living, I should say. I know you're more focused on Ukrainian nationalists than on Russian, and you're focused on the European far right in general. But what would you be watching for in the Russian march next week?
Well, you know, I think what's been really interesting is to observe these fractions between the what we're calling the ethnic nationalists and the state nationalists really coming to the fore right now. And, you know, following the Ukrainian crisis and also the annexation of Crimea. And I think this is something that has stayed in the shadows for a very long time. And I think from the West, we've observed, you know, the rise in the Putinist agenda, the populist nationalist rhetoric as more of a coherent ideological movement that's really focused on controlling the message. And I think what we're seeing now has been really interesting to see that, you know, Russia and the Kremlin is not any different than, you know, other nationalist movements in places like Ukraine or other Western, Eastern European countries, where we see quite a few fractionalizations and divisions within the nationalist clan, so to say. And so I think what's been interesting to observe as well is to take this a bit to a broader perspective, is to what extent the Kremlin itself and this the state nationalist grouping has been reaching out to Western European far-right parties, which themselves consider themselves as nationalist political parties as well. And this relationship has been, I think, producing some very interesting outcomes. For example, during electoral periods, in March in Crimea, we saw that the only election observers, quote-unquote, that were allowed to come to the referendum were actually members of these far-right Western European parties. And the same thing happened during the regional elections just in September in Russia. So I think what we see is, on the one hand, the state nationalists reaching out to more of this transnational network of the far-right nationalist groups. And perhaps that's also fueling some resentment among the more extremist ethnic nationalists as well.
Yeah, but, no, oh, go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, I was going to say, but I also agree that I don't think we were going to see this anti-Putinist, anti-Kremlin move coming from the ethnic nationalist group anytime soon.
I mean, we were seeing it a year or so ago, a little more than a year or so ago. But I mean, this is one of the foot soldiers of a lot of Navalny's movement were ethnic nationalists. Those people that were on the streets of Moscow the night Navalny was in prison, I don't want to say they're all nationalists, but I mean, the nationalists are they can put people on the streets, and they did. And Navalny's ability to put people on the streets was largely tied to this. But the ethnic nationalists were against Putin. Kevin, you pointed out in your piece, Sputnik and Pogrom, where they favored the annexation of Crimea. They liked this imperialism, but they look at the Putin regime as an oligarchic regime, just like its predecessor, which nationalists hated.
Well, the Kremlin has, for a lot of people of that persuasion, the Kremlin hasn't gone far enough. And you've pointed out how, you know, Sokolov is like now being, or he's been sort of erased from Russian media coverage. And there have been a number of sort of strange, you know, machinations in the Donbass, in these rebel republics, where, you know, people are sort of disappear. Not literally, I mean, but they just sort of they cease to be prominent individuals. Mm-hmm. And the implication, I think, that a lot of people are drawing is that the Kremlin is kind of is getting rid of people that are a little too noisy, that are a little too eager to resume the conflict, and so on. That the Kremlin is essentially managing this and limiting, you know, the expanse of Novorossiya or whatever. Yeah. And so people are upset about that. And I do think that – I don't think that the Russki Marsh is necessarily going to be very anti-Putin. I don't think that that's going to be, you know, those are not going to be the slogans of the day. I think they're going to – if anything, if they get it at all a little bit anti-government, it might have to do more with immigration services. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, don't give visas to people of – whatever, people from Central Asia and so on. I mean, that's usually there. And I know that they're even like officially marching under some of those slogans. And those are, I mean, granted, those are not, you know, overtly anti-Putin causes, but it's, I think, immigration and, you know, the kind of slippery slope into ethnic issues or, you know, racism, I suppose, that can very quickly become anti-Kremlin and then anti-Putin. I do think that those issues, if they gain enough momentum, they can really kind of become very big very quickly. And I mean, and it's so that hasn't happened. You know, Putin hasn't been thrown out of the Kremlin by a racist mob or anything like that. But when you look at the ethnic explosions that occur in Russia periodically, like the last big one was the Biryulova riot. Right. And people went crazy about
yes,
that.
They I mean, did.
And it wasn't really
they
that
did a podcast about it.
Yeah, yeah, and it wasn't that. I mean, they didn't. A city did not burn to the ground or anything like that. But you can just see, you know, how sensitive Russian society is to these sorts of things. And when something like that happens, I think the reaction is so big because people, I think, accurately believe that that sort of thing could get out of hand very quickly, yeah. Because there is this sort of undercurrent of populist anger about these issues. And in fact, Prasvirnin, I keep coming back to him because I do think he's kind of one of the most interesting Russian nationalists today. And his website is, you know, very, very popular. And that's – I work on the internet. So – but at any rate, he's convinced that the worsening economic situation in Russia is going to make nationalist issues a lot more potent politically. And there was even this week, actually, another example of this kind of, you know, seemingly more or less small thing that becomes a really kind of a larger – it creates a much larger social reaction. Was there was this study published in Nyanta.ru that it broke down – it was an ethnic breakdown of Russia's 200 richest businessmen. They took the Forbes list and through a questionable methodology, admittedly, but they said, okay, well, so much – you know, Russians make up whatever it is, 44% – of the richest, you know, 200 Russian citizens, but they make up 80% of the population, and you know, Jews are way more,
right.
and Ukrainians are way more, and mountain Jews and Chechens and so on, and people were really upset about this. One, because the methodology wasn't so good, so it was, you know, that's racist, right. Or whatever. But then, you know, there were questions. Well, what if they had done it with better methodology? Is it still racist? And
right.
Why are we so upset about this? Like, what issues is this tapping into? And I think that, you know, if you follow the breadcrumbs all the way, you'll get to a potentially like revolutionary subject in Russia.
Yeah, no, and it's a subject that spooks the Kremlin, and they have stoked this thing that spooks them to their ends in the Ukraine crisis.
Yeah.
But now you're starting to see them retrench a little bit. There's been there've been claims out there that the Kremlin is preventing volunteers from entering Donbass. Moscow City Hall banned an October 5 demonstration for in favor of the battle for Donbass. You mentioned the Sputniki pogrom case. The Conservative Alliance has said that all bridges have been burned with the regime. Alexei Zhivov of the Conservative Alliance has said that. Konstantin Kirillov of the National Democratic Party has said, "We are feeling betrayed and abandoned." And there's a sense that the Kremlin is trying to, if not crack down, rein this in. And it has some elements of a potential crackdown, or at least the threat of a crackdown. Mark, why now? Why do this now? Is it time just to rein in this monster?
Well, I think to answer that, let me just pull back slightly. And I think if we're going to talk about nationalism, I think a handy way of thinking about it is that obviously there's a whole variety of different nationalisms, but it can be sort of triangulated, or I suppose actually technically kind of quadrilateralized, between four particular sort of themes or issues. I mean, there's empire, which is a straightforward, you know, basically, do we have lots of territory and can we throw our weight around in the world? There are issues of race, of Russians versus all these other people. There we are, is the social agenda, social conservatism, you know, sort of do we properly stomp on the rights of gays and that kind of thing. And then there is the fourth one, which, you know, I think it is worth noting precisely that nationalism is often twinned with a level of radicalism, essentially an economic agenda that basically says, look, actually, we Russians also sort of have to have a certain form of kind of social equity amongst us and such like, and particularly when that's also mixed in, as Kevin was saying, with the sort of a sense that, in fact, this oligarchic regime is stacked against the interests of Russians. And so, I mean, I think, in a way, the issue for the Kremlin is precisely when the center of gravity within Russian nationalism begins to creep away from the corners that the Kremlin is happier with, which is basically the empire and social conservatism,
mm-hmm.
and towards the race issue, which after all immediately starts to sort of run the risk of further inter-ethnic conflagrations, which make the country much harder to govern, and actually force the Kremlin to make a choice between doing the rational thing, which is after all supporting the rights of non-Russian peoples and non-Russian local authorities, or doing the populist thing and therefore alienating the Tatars and everyone else. And also the economic dimension. And again, here we now find that Russia is heading, sliding rapidly towards deeper economic troubles. And troubles which are inevitably going to sharpen the real as well as the perceived wealth gap. Mm. And I think this is particularly why the Kremlin would be worried at the moment. It's not really able to trumpet any new successes on the imperial front. It can't really do very much more on the social conservatism front, quite frankly.
Right.
It really does not want to open up the race issue. And in economic terms, it has nothing to offer the masses, because precisely it's not about to launch some massive redistribution of wealth and crack down on the oligarchs and the kind of corrupt bureaucrats who are the other sort of brand of the elite. No. So I think for all these points of view, its opportunities for traction on the nationalist movement are diminished, and the risks within nationalism are increasing. So I think that's why they're probably trying to nip it in the bud prophylactically now.
No, you raised a lot of things to talk about here. One thing is that when you look at the empire corner, you noted, and the race corner, these two things are just in many ways mutually incompatible. I mean, if you want to restore the old Soviet Union, you're going to have a lot of non-Russians living in it, right? I guess.
But I think empire, I mean, I don't think anyone really thinks that actually, no one is saying, let's get Uzbekistan back. That's what we really want, or whatever. Absolutely not. No, I mean, it's a different form of empire. It's one that is essentially where there are substantial communities of ethnic Russians and Russian values and so forth still stand. So it's, you know, maybe northern Kazakhstan, perhaps. But I think, I mean, empire also carries with it that sense of being a power in the world. You know, it's not just simply about aggregate square kilometerage and so forth. So, I mean, yes, it can be problematic trying to square it with race. But on the whole, in the past, Putin's regime had managed to do that. It had managed to kind of present itself as the defender of Russian rights abroad. Mm-hmm. And that was precisely why Crimea was so, one of the many reasons why Crimea was precisely so popular. And one of the reasons why what's now going on in the Donbass is so increasingly problematic. Because it really does emphasize this challenge that they sort of went in there, and that even if not necessarily saying so, but you know, allowed it to be with a nod and a wink, obvious that they were there to defend the rights of Russians against non-Russians. And now they're at the point where basically the interests of statecraft mean you do not escalate any further, and in fact you try desperately looking for a solution. Whereas the interests of stoking the nationalists would say, by all means, send in the tank brigades.
Right. Now, on the other one of the other corners you noted here, the economic populism corner, again, this is particularly dangerous, as Kevin also pointed out. I mean, not only do they have nothing to offer in terms of redistribution, I mean, they're going to have not a lot to offer in terms of redistribution among themselves if this continues. I mean, the ruble is plummeting to new lows almost daily. I know the central bank intervened yesterday and managed to prop it up a little bit, but I read a report today that it could fall as low as 50. Because the dollar, because the ruble is overvalued anyway, the dollar's gaining against major currencies anyway, the combined impact of capital flight, declining oil prices, the West diversifying its energy, it's a perfect storm, or a poisonous cocktail, or however you want to look at it. And this is where it could really get dangerous for them, because if you have economic deprivation, it's fertile ground for these kinds of nationalists. Alina, you've been listening patiently. I know you probably have a lot to say about all of this, because you write a lot about this. What are your thoughts?
Well, I just want to pick up on the point about how the worsening economic situation is exacerbating some of these cracks that we're seeing within the nationalist pro-Kremlin movement. And again, I think that's a point that we can't really understate, honestly. Because with the worsening economic situation, be it the result of sanctions or the result of the falling oil prices or the perfect storm of all of these things, is putting the Kremlin in a bit of a, you know, catch-22, right? Do you make the choice between the sort of the populist base, or do you go with your friends and the elites, right? And I think, Kevin, in your article, you mentioned the Rotenberg Law that's making its way through the Duma right now, which is basically you can speak more to is aimed to protect the longtime friends of the regime, basically, by subsidizing whatever losses they may have from the sanctions from the European Union and the U.S. On the other hand, you know, if we look at, you know, comparative cases, right, we do see some relationship between, you know, for example, the financial crisis that just happened in 2008 and the sovereign debt crisis that followed in Western European economies in places like Greece, right, where as unemployment rates were skyrocketing, as the country kind of hurled towards default almost, we saw for the first time the rise of very extremist right-wing movement, the Golden Dawn in Greece. But this hasn't been happening across the board, right? And I think there's just, so we can't necessarily say that it's the economy that will then causally produce, you know, some sort of machination within the far right or produce more extremism. Or I think what we do see is that it definitely produces problems for the ruling elite, not just in Russia, but across all countries that then have to address grievances that they no longer can address in terms of economic, social programs. And so I think in that way, Russia is not that different from quite a few Western European countries that have had to deal with these more extremist movements and these nationalist movements who are now demanding from their regimes to address their economic deprivation.
And you mentioned Greece, and also we have the case of Hungary, which is an
exactly.
interesting case on the heels of the 2008 financial crisis. This allowed Viktor Orban's right-wing party to come to power. But the second most powerful part, the second strongest party and most popular party in Hungary is Jobbik, the extremely far-right party. So I think there is some cause for concern here. I want to play a clip of Vladimir Putin speaking in Sochi at the Valdai Discussion Club about what he thinks of nationalism, or at least what he said at the time he thinks about nationalism.
Самый большой националист в России это я. Но самый большой, самый правильный националист.
I am the biggest nationalist in Russia. The thing is, the greatest and most appropriate kind of nationalism is when you act and formulate policies that will benefit the people. However, if nationalism is to mean intolerance of other people or chauvinism, this would destroy our country, which has been built as a multi-ethnic and multi-confessional state. Not only this would lead us into a dead end, but it would also result in self-destruction. Russia will do everything possible to make sure this doesn't happen.
Mark, what kind of message do you think Putin was trying to send here?
Well, again, what he's trying to do is define, as it were, the acceptable parameters of nationalism. I mean, it's very hard to feel any sympathy for someone being hoisted by their own petard. But this is the point. I mean, that in previous times, when it's been much safer for him, he's been very happy to allow nationalism to develop for all kinds of reasons, ranging from it being a safety valve for sort of feelings on the streets to being one way in which he's been able to mobilize support and castigate his opponents. But now I think, again, we're seeing that awareness on, if not Putin purely, but also the people around him, that nationalism actually can become problematic. And the fact that, again, he's trying to redefine or define the acceptable level of nationalism as being not about racism, not about intercommunal violence, intercommunal tensions, not about essentially a radical social agenda, but instead being about patriotism. And I think that's the key thing. When he says nationalism, he really means patriotism. In other words, loyalty to the status quo and a sort of a status quo on steroids if need be, but basically with no particular shifts carried with it. This is not a radical nationalism, and that, I think, is what he fears.
Kevin, would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I would. But the one question I'd ask, though, is if we're all kind of assuming that the audience, the intended audience for that statement, I think we're all assuming is that Putin was speaking to fellow Russians trying to, like you say, Mark, lay out parameters for what is acceptable nationalism. One other way to read it, I'm not sure it's the better way, but another way to read it would be what does it mean if the audience was actually, say, Europe, for instance? Now, I say that because there was a really interesting op-ed that came out after the Valdai speech by Tatiana Stanovaya, whom, if you don't read, I recommend her stuff.
I concur in that recommendation.
Yeah, she's one of the best. She writes for Salon and Politkom.ru, and she's fantastic. She's also prolific. It's amazing.
Yeah, I don't know how she finds the time to write as much as she does.
And she's based she's not even based in Moscow. She's based in France, so she's a testament to telecommuting or something. Her argument was essentially that most – she didn't say specifically the nationalist comment, but she was saying that the Putin's Valdai statements were actually intended for Europeans, and it was sort of just as the Munich speech of 2007, I think it was, that was also intended for the Europeans, and it was the message was essentially for Munich. It was the Americans aren't playing by their own rules, like. You know, let's all play together, and Russia's an equal partner in this. And that now in Valdai, what he said is the Americans aren't playing by their own rules. Let's just us get together. Now that goes in the face of a lot of popular wisdom right now. In fact, Lilia Shevtsova is in D.C. this week, and she gave two speeches already saying that Putin's all about breaking away from Europe, and now it's all going to China. And this is a common theme in commentary about Russia. But if we entertain the idea that Putin was actually – that he hasn't cut all ties to Europe and that he's still entertaining the notion that he can speak to them. And I do think that a lot of his the way he deals with Germany in particular – and people have noted, obviously, his warm feelings for Merkel and so on, despite – you know, her more recent coldness.
They're not being reciprocated at the moment.
Yes, but he still seems to be trying it anyway. And this was something Stanovoy pointed out.
By being 3 hours late for a meeting.
Well, that's par for the course. I mean, you can't hold that. That's nothing personal. I just wonder if perhaps those comments about nationalism. And I'd be curious what Alina thinks about this because she works on the far right in Europe. I wonder if that's addressed, to the far right in Europe, if he's trying to build bridges that way, or if it's just this more general kind of rhetoric of, to be a nationalist is to be a patriot, and that's there's nothing so scary or strange about that. I don't know, but I'm interested in kind of exploring those ideas.
What about that, Alina? How did you read these comments? Then I want to follow up with a talk about the ties to the far right in Europe as well, but.
Yeah, well, I think in some ways, both of you are right. I think when we read these kinds of speeches coming out of the Kremlin, coming from Putin, they're always multidimensional. And I think they have multiple audiences, right? I think that's very clear. And I think that if we think about these particular sets of comments that Putin made recently, I think it is in some ways directed not just towards the far right in Europe, which honestly, Putin doesn't have to do much to win their admiration. I mean, he's already widely admired by the National Front in France and the Austrian Freedom Party. And of course, there's been rumors and some circumstantial evidence that the Kremlin has directly financially supported far-right groups in Central Eastern Europe, among them Jobbik and also the Bulgarian far-right Ataka Party. So I think he doesn't have to do much, right, except just maintain his sort of macho Russia, the great patriotic state image, which he does perfectly well anyways. And I think, making Angela Merkel wait for 3 hours for that meeting in Italy was no different than that. It was, I think, in some ways to also show that, Russia and Putin, who sees himself, I think, as representing Russia, has that kind of power to make the leader of the European Union wait. And I think it was a very clear power play. And on the other hand, I think, it is also the thing the Kremlin finds itself in a very dangerous position, as we already said, in terms of its own domestic situation. And I think reining in these more extremist nationalist interests and nationalist movements in Russia will become a broader domestic agenda. And so I think what we heard coming from Putin was aimed at multiple audiences, is what I would say to that.
Yeah, and you would have to wonder if they haven't created a monster that they cannot control, although I suspect they will control it. Alina, I want to stick with you and go into your area of expertise here. This is Russia's ties to the far right in Europe. I read a recent piece in the Russian media arguing that Putin is trying to create a fascist international. I don't know if anybody else saw that piece, but it was inevitable that somebody was going to use that line at some point. What is the goal here? though? What is the goal of these ties to far-right parties in Europe? Is it a belief that they could possibly take power in some European countries and they're going to turn Western countries into Russian allies? Is it a parallel of the old Communist International? Or what's the goal here? What are they trying to do?
Yeah, you know, it's a very good question. I think right now we can only speculate about that, obviously, but I wouldn't go as far as to talk about it as this, the Soviet International or, the Fascist International. I think these ties are not also necessarily unique to Putin. I mean, we saw even under Yeltsin and Zhirinovsky trying to reach out to some of these far-right groups as well. It's just now it's become part of the Russian
policy.
State institution, exactly. It sort of left this kind of fringe movement and become mainstream. For me, I think that we saw most of this kind of cooperation really coming to the fore since the Ukrainian crisis started. And, if we look at this, things like the European parliamentary election that just took place in May, at the same time as the Ukrainian presidential elections, which was very interesting to observe both of those events happening at the same time and on the same day. Because, of course, what we saw in the European Parliament is that the far-right groups took a huge proportion of the votes. And, you can say different things about the European Parliament not really having much power and just being a giant bureaucracy that's nothing. But on the other hand, I think it is indicative of a general trend within European societies that are very anti-EU. And these parties are no longer fringe parties. Many of them are, second largest parties, just like Jobbik. I recently saw a poll that if Marine Le Pen, who's the leader of the Front National, or the National Front in France, a poll that asked, who would you vote for if the presidential election was held tomorrow? And she did really well, and it actually showed her coming in first. This kind of situation, I think, could play out very favorably for the Kremlin. Even if these parties never become the majority parties, it's very clear that there's a lot of resentment over how the European Union has handled the financial crisis, over the continuing sluggish economy. If you look at any polls conducted since the financial crisis, we see a huge spike in Euroscepticism. And really, even the most pro-European populations, which are typically the Germans, and to a smaller extent, the Dutch and the Danes, they're really moving away from Europe. And we see this play out in countries in various ways.
I'd add a couple of things to that, too. I mean, it's not only in the economic issues we see it happening, and it's not only reaching out to the European far right. There was an interesting item. I don't know if any of you saw it a couple of weeks back, but the Kremlin-backed groups aligned with U.S. evangelicals in Estonia to try to prevent the Estonian parliament from passing a same-sex civil unions law. They were unsuccessful. Estonia passed it and became the first post-Soviet state to pass such legislation. So there was that. In one area where it is kind of paying off, if you look at, like, in Hungary, you see kind of almost Putin clonism going on there. I mean, there were discussions of a foreign agent law. They never passed it yet, but they were discussing having NGOs be designated as foreign agents in Hungary, which is part of the European Union. So Orban sounds increasingly kind of pro-Putin and sometimes downright Putin-esque lately. So now I'm not sure. I don't expect Hungary to be replicated throughout the European Union, but maybe there are people in the Kremlin who are dreaming of such a thing. Before we move on to the second section, just Mark and Kevin, any last thoughts on this issue of the outreach to the far right in Europe?
I mean, I very much say, although I love the notion of a fashion turn, for me, it's absolutely disruptive. It's just simply, basically they will go to any movement. I mean, in the same way as they have been, for example, supportive of anti-fracking environmental movements in some cases, because they clearly don't want the thought of Europe having any more hydrocarbons. This is it. It's just simply ways in which they can create wedges and open wedges and fissures within the Western alliance. Also knowing full well that you might say there are people who are now in opposition and therefore are happy to be wooed. But, for example, a Marine Le Pen government in Paris would not, I think it's fair to say, be a Russophile one. You know, there are alliances of convenience that make sense when you're an outsider, which would not, actually, if you ever move to the center.
Right. Yeah, no, and so this is just another wedge issue, just like the Kremlin pretending to be environmentalists, to be against fracking, to protect Gazprom's interests. Although I would say that there has been kind of a PR push from the Kremlin about how Putin is the biggest conservative leader in the world. I blogged this back about a half a year ago, and there does seem to be a little bit of conviction behind this. Maybe the utility of it is simply useful as a wedge, though. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and look at one of the consequences of all this nationalism, economic nationalism, and why Russian officials seem to think go-it-alone autarky might be a good thing for the country. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Washington, D.C. is Kevin Rothrock, editor of Runet Echo at Global Voices and an indispensable observer of the Russian blogosphere. And joining us from Bern, Switzerland, is Alina Polyakova, a senior research fellow at the University of Bern and an expert on the far right in Europe. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Западные санкции против России нарушают принципы...
Санкции, конечно, создали ряд трудностей российским банкам.
Любые санкции – это зло.
Производство сыров и сырных продуктов, а также мяса...
Положительное влияние оказали те самые антироссийские санкции.
Производство в России в сентябре неожиданно выросло на 2...
Перевыполнены задания по выпуску промышленной продукции. Собран самый высокий урожай зерна и хлопка за всю историю нашей страны.
We don't need the West, we can make it ourselves, or we can buy it from China. The flip side of nationalism is autarky, and suddenly, autarky is all the rage in Russia. Some officials have argued that sanctions will actually be good for the Russian economy because they will help domestic producers. Mark, we were discussing this off mic this week, and actually you're the reason we're doing this bit on this is the second segment here. And I know you have some things to say for this about this notion, so go for it.
Excellent, a sanctioned rant. I would want to make 4 points very briefly. I mean, first of all, this idea that actually sanctions will allow Russia to do what Russia has failed to do up to now, which is to diversify and to keep up with, I'd say Western, but we have to actually call it rather sort of leading edge technology, since after all, China is no slouch these days. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen for a variety of reasons, ranging from the fact that there just is not the money, which is the sort of the key thing. You need to have the credits and the technologies. And those are precisely the things that actually are being squeezed away from Russia and precisely the things that they can't find elsewhere. It also means that you have to have the kind of breathing space to be able to take your production facilities and so forth offline while you retool them, re-engineer them, retrain your workforces and so forth. It's not fast, it's not pretty, it's not easy, and it's not cheap. And in a way, Russia doesn't have any of those resources. Secondly, I mean, if the idea is you're going to buy it abroad, well, remind me with what? As the ruble plummets, and despite the fact that they've already spent $2.7 billion trying to actually keep it propped up, they're failing. And okay, there's going to be a bit of a sort of every now and then little sort of dead cat bounce. But nonetheless, the ruble is going to be a weak currency. Oil prices are low, and again, they're not about to suddenly sort of spike
once
again.
The long-term trend is for them to continue going down, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And also we're seeing some sort of evidence of pressure on gas markets too. So, for all these reasons, the idea that you can import, well, it's fine if actually what you're doing is you're shifting from instead of European apples to buying Iranian apples. Fine, you can see those in the stores, no problem. But if we're talking about big-ticket items, large, expensive, and sophisticated ones, it's again... No one is going to be basically extending vast amounts of credit on easy terms to Russia. Even if you look at the credits that China has been extending, they're not on easy terms. This is something that we talked about last week. So, I mean, there isn't the money, there isn't the space. Third reason is if you're going to start moving your procurement increasingly to other countries other than the West, well, the interesting thing is actually – there has been a slight shift towards a degree of transparency within the economic system.
created by the need to be able to deal with the West and therefore get involved in the whole issues of due diligence and credit guarantees and such like. If you start moving to elsewhere, you're increasingly be engaging with countries with rather more, let's be honest, corrupt systems. And actually that's going to be a further impetus for the sort of spread of corruption and embezzlement within what is already a deeply corrupt system. And I should actually stress, I can't claim the credit for that last point. It was thanks to a colleague of mine, Catherine Wilkins. Ah. But it does mean that what we're seeing is, that actually likelihood is that at the very point where they need to be doing something about this waste of resources, they're probably going to find even more scope for embezzlement within the system. And the final point is, look, this is incredibly dangerous. At best, it's whistling in the dark. At worst, it demonstrates absolute and downright ignorance. And again, I think it reflects this point that at the moment we have a regime that is not really listening to economists. It doesn't have people who understand world finances within its sort of central system. Even the likes of Sechin do not. And its view is that essentially the people who do, that their job is just simply they are managers. Their job is to do as they're told. And the result is that policy is a combination of wishful thinking and clear narrow sectarian interests. Mm. We've got Sechin pushing various forms of counter-sanctions that would all happen to work for his own hydrocarbon empire. There's even implications that Bastrykin, good old Bastrykin, who we haven't been able to talk about for a while.
We haven't talked about him in a while.
Exactly. So bless him. I feel the need to bring him back in. Head of the investigatory committee has been once again mooting the need for a crackdown on embezzlement and even what we could really call expropriations. Mm. Not necessarily, I think, because he really is desperately concerned about the economic efficiency of the Russian state, but because precisely it would once again bring him into center stage. So I think the trouble is that the more Russians talk about this, the less they're actually addressing the realities of the situation, the need not only to make up for the terrible waste of the noughts when they had the time and the money and could have diversified, but also more broadly, if they think that they can absorb sanctions, then they have less reasons to do anything about the root issues which have created the sanctions regime and will, in the process, drive their economy further into the ground as a result.
Now, I heard an interesting theory behind this. The political scientist Ivan Krastev, who I recommend everybody read as well, was saying he thinks that that Putin was spooked so much by the fact that a lot of his inner circle wanted him to negotiate with the street back in late 2011, 2012. And Putin and Ivanov and others in the inner circle were so spooked by this. They said, we're too integrated in the world. We're too tied in with this globalized world economy because that's the only reason these people are spooked by this. We have to pull back from this. But he doesn't want to build the wall. He wants us to build the wall. He wants us to build the wall. Now, the end result of this, of course, is going to be this some kind of autarky. But one has to wonder if... I mean, because the logical conclusion of this is when you get down, that gets down to consumers, basic consumer goods are going to disappear from the shelves. And you have to wonder how patriotic and nationalistic Russians are going to be when they can't get their iPhones anymore. Kevin, what about that? What do you think? I mean, will this autarky undermine the nationalism that's driving it at the end of the day?
Well, one question I had, Mark, you mentioned that Sechin's been pushing this expropriation stuff. I was under the impression he denied that. And then, so I wonder if, are you suggesting that was just a trial balloon? Or, because the other reading that I thought was a little bit more plausible was that it was basically like black PR that someone was putting out against him. Mm. But I don't know, maybe...
The Kommersant article you're talking
about.
Yeah,
because then he said, I think he said he's going to sue Kommersant. And again, it could all be a trial balloon part of the show or whatever. But,
yeah.
Oh, no. What did you think about that, Mark?
Well, I think the interesting thing is that, Sechin has multiple roles. I think the point was the initial suggestion was that, as it were, Rosneft was making this suggestion.
Right.
And that's really what they're pushing back, and by implication saying that it wasn't Sechin. Whereas actually there is suggestions that within the TEK, his alternative sort of function within more the state apparatus, that he's been pushing this idea for counter-sanctions.
Mm.
Again, this is still we're at sort of this splendidly conspiratorial sort of level. But certainly reading the statements, it very much kept stressing, no, Rosneft does not believe this, rather than actually saying, and Sechin thinks it's a load of rubbish. Because interestingly enough, also Sechin has not at all chosen to dissociate himself from the suggestions. He said,
That's
wasn't
right.
me.
That's right.
He hasn't said, and I think it's a bad idea.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, because the Gazprom stuff is like perfectly in line with things he's been pushing for a while now. You know, breaking up the monopoly and so on.
Right.
But you're saying that he's actually not disassociating himself from even the expropriation of companies if they want to leave, like we get to keep their equipment kind of deal.
I mean, certainly that's how I'm reading the statements at the moment. I could be completely wrong, but that just it felt to me as that it was interesting that even the denials have been very, very carefully calibrated denials.
Right, right. Well, so Brian, to get back to the iPhones and so on.
The consumer deprivation. I mean, the autarky is going to result in consumer deprivation, and was that going to undermine the nationalism that caused the autarky in the beginning?
I gotta say, I like the Yoda phone. I don't have one, but it looks cool. Although I guess it does run Android. So I don't know a whole lot about I assume you're right that if true autarky were ever realized, and I don't think it probably would be, just for lots of reasons. But let's just assume it is somehow. I think that when it comes to the internet, anyway. So this is more software, websites, and so on, not iPhones and
right.
I don't know, Apple TVs or whatever. But the Russian internet companies actually, they do really quite well. And I think that if you push out a lot of Western competitors, they'll do even better. And I know that a lot of Russians that work in tech and software and websites and so on, they're not all that unhappy about pressure on their foreign competitors. And in fact, every now and then you'll get a kind of unscientific survey of people that work in that sector that appears on some of these like business websites, like Zuckerberg, Zvonit, and like there was another one that merged with The Village. At any rate, I forget what it's called now. Oh, yeah, I forget what it's called. But at any rate, they're connected to this whole group of people. And my intuition, my impression of reading this sort of thing, following it, is that they're not all that concerned about it. And it's not so much that they need it to survive. They're actually doing pretty well. If you look at it, just for social media use, for instance, lots of talk about Facebook, Twitter, getting pressure. And if this data server law comes into force in a year and a half, is it the end? Does it spell the end of Facebook or Twitter in Russia? And that would be monumental for civil society, because Russia's, independently minded citizen activists are all over Facebook, all over Twitter. It's their lifeline. But most Russians don't use these services. Odnoklassniki, which is a horrible website, I think, personally, and Vkontakte, which is fine. These are enormously popular. Mm. And then Facebook, and then Twitter. But the numbers for them are in the single digits. I think maybe Facebook might be at 12%, but Twitter's at 8%, I think, whereas Vkontakte and Odnoklassniki are huge. Right. And so they're winning. They're already doing better than their Western competitors. They've already, conquered the market. Now, with search engines, Yandex is ahead of Google, but Google's sort of making gains. I mean, Google's good, et cetera, et cetera. They're not in dire need of this sort of thing. And if by hook or crook or whatever, they manage to achieve autarky, and at least in the online sphere.
But
I don't see it making, first of all, you have to have
hardware. You have to have hardware to run all that cool software on, number one.
Yeah, but I mean, how hard is it? I mean, Grant, sure. I mean, I see your point. I mean,
the point is beyond iPhones. I mean, consumers are going to get general deprivation. I remember the 1998 economic crisis. I was in Petersburg, and it was amazing how quickly all the Western goods, and I'm talking everything from candy bars to computers and watches, disappeared from the shelves in a matter of days. It was mind-blowing. Right. I don't know if we were in Moscow or in Russia at the time, but it was mind-blowing. And I'm wondering if we're going to eventually move towards something like that, because people were pretty pissed off.
If there's a mind-blowing apocalyptic scenario of barren shelves in Moscow, yes, there would be instability.
but would it undermine the national? Alina, you've been quiet. I want to bring you in. What do you have any thoughts on this?
Well, I was just thinking as we were talking, I think Crimea is going to be a very interesting test case for this, honestly. Because since the annexation, we've had just a dearth of information coming out of Crimea. And, but one thing we have known is that there have been shortages there already, given the difficulty of getting products to Crimea from Russia. And so I think just to bring it back in some ways to what we started this conversation with, I think the Russian march that takes place in Crimea is going to be interesting to observe for that reason as well. I mean, to what extent, given the issues that, you know, which is basic consumer goods that we've observed in Crimea, to what extent is this nationalist march going to get popular support? I think that's going to be an interesting thing to watch.
Yeah, no, I think that might be one of the most interesting things to watch in the day. And it'll be interesting to watch, as you point out, what happens and how Crimeans are going to be living as opposed to people in the rest of Ukraine. And if they might get some buyer's remorse there at some point, or at least those in support of the annexation may at some point get buyer's remorse if Ukraine does manage to turn things around. Anybody have any last points they want to make before we wrap it up for the week? And I see Mark does. No? No, Mark's saying no. Okay. Well, Kevin's smiling, and I can't see Alina, but...
I'm smiling, but...
Okay. Well, on that note, I guess we'll wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And also joining us via Skype from Washington, D.C. has been Kevin Rothrock, editor of Runet Echo at Global Voices and an indispensable observer of the Russian blogosphere. And joining us from Bern, Switzerland has been Alina Polyakova, a senior research fellow at the University of Bern and an expert on the far right in Europe. Thank you all for the enlightening discussion.
A pleasure.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank our patient, brilliant, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my totally awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome and indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow, at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and the newly launched Power Vertical feed at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noize MC.